Coming up on Tech News Weekly, I'm Jason Howell, and I start today's show talking with Kyle Orland from Ars Technica. He joins to talk about the Unity price structure change and how developers are upset.
And I'm Micah Sargent, and we talk to the Mozilla Foundation's own Misha Rykov about how cars are the worst product category they've ever reviewed in terms of privacy and security.
Man, yeah, that's some pretty scary stuff. Also, my story of the week about MGM and Caesars, you know, the Vegas properties, as well as around the U.S. and other places. Ransomware attacked. They each have a very different strategy for how they deal with it.
Plus, the U.S. has kicked off its 10-week trial with Google. It is the modern web's look at a company that may be trying to take over the internet, at least when it comes to search engines. All that and more coming up on Tech News Weekly.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 303, recorded Thursday, September 14th, 2023. Developers unite against Unity. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by our friends, IT Pro TV, now ACI Learning. IT skills are outdated in about 18 months. Launch or advance your career today with quality, affordable, entertaining training. Individuals use code TWIT30 for 30% off a standard or premium individual IT Pro membership at go.acilearning.com/twit.
And by ExpressVPN. If you really want to go incognito and protect your privacy, make yourself as invisible as possible with the number one rated VPN, ExpressVPN. For 3 extra months free with a 1-year package, go to expressvpn.com/TNW.
And by Drata. All too often, security professionals are undergoing the tedious and arduous task of manually collecting evidence. With Drata, companies can complete audits, monitor controls, and expand security assurance efforts to scale. Say goodbye to manual evidence collection and hello to automation, all done at Drata speed. Visit drata.com/twit to get a demo and 10% off implementation.
Hello and welcome to Tech News Weekly, the show where every week we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news. I am one of your hosts, Micah Sargent.
I'm the other guy. I'm back, Jason Howell.
Hello,
good
Jason.
To see you, Micah.
It's good to see you too.
Yeah, thanks for covering for me last week while I was at my nephew's wedding. It was beautiful. It was wonderful. And, you know, as is always the case, you take your foot off the gas pedal of technology news, even for a week.
And then you go, where and then you come is back. And,
yes, it really is a scramble. It's like, how do I recalibrate?
I'm still paused on the fact that you have a nephew old enough to be married.
Me too.
I wouldn't expect that. So
I can't believe
that. Congrats to your nephew.
Yes, indeed. It's crazy to watch the little ones become big ones and then suddenly get married. Anyways, let's talk about some tech news. And actually, this story is a biggie, especially if you go to the Ars Technica article that we're going to be discussing today. You'll see it has an insane amount of comments, which means people are angry. The gaming industry in upheaval this week with the news that the Unity engine was implementing a new fee structure. And I'll give you 3 guesses. Pretty divisive is what it is. Kyle Orland wrote about this for ours and is here for a return visit. It's good to have you back, Kyle.
Hey, thanks. Good to see you, Jason.
Yeah, good to see you too. So before we get into the massive, amount of changes and all the work that you're doing kind of tracking the legal issues of this story, first of all, what is Unity's pricing structure now? Because it's easy to think that like the change happens immediately. It doesn't happen until the end of the year, but it's coming. Right. It's looming and people are upset about it. What is it prior to the change at this point?
So right now, Unity is proudly the royalty-free game engine, and that's why it's been so popular with a large segment of the game development community. In fact, if you're using the personal version and you're not making, I think, $100,000 a year in revenue, you can get it completely free. You can release your game and not have to pay any other fees, any other percent of revenue or anything. Now, once you start making a little bit of revenue, you have to start paying for the pro or industrial versions of the engine, but that's just a per site license like you would have for any other software where you pay, a few thousand dollars and you get full access to the full version of the engine for all your developers. But you still don't have to pay, any percentage of your revenues. You don't have to pay for every sale, you know, a small bit like you do to Steam, for instance. You just get the engine and you use it. And that's why people like it.
And is it kind of alone, or rather, has it been somewhat alone in that regard? Like, has it been kind of the choice for indie developers because of this low to no price structure compared to some of the other competitors out there?
Yeah, the big and small developers actually like it because of this. Unreal has, in recent years, introduced a structure where the first $1 million of revenue are royalty free because they want people to, the smaller developers, to actually try out Unreal. But after that, you have to pay, I think, 5% of your revenue to Unreal once you have a $1 million game. And everyone thinks they're going to have a $1 million game. So they're like, I'm not really sure I want to go with Unreal. So a lot of people stick with Unity, especially as students, you know, since you can get the free educational license, a lot of schools teach Unity and just give all their students Unity to make these projects that aren't going to make money. So why not use a full functioning free engine, essentially?
Yeah, yeah, indeed. All right. So obviously things are changing. Otherwise, we probably wouldn't be talking about it in these terms. So what is the new pricing structure and why is everybody so upset?
So the new pricing structure introduces a per install fee. Once you get to a certain level, it depends a lot on whether you're using the free personal version or the pro versions that you have to pay for initially. But once you hit a certain threshold of success, it starts at $200,000 of revenue and 200,000 installs. Then you have to start paying per install, up to 20 cents per install. Now, this is kind of unique in the industry. You know, there are revenue shares all over the place, you know, Steam, Unreal, like we talked about. Mm-hmm. Paying per install is not really something that's ever been done. Unity says they have this unique algorithm that can track how many times your game is installed without actually using any like privacy invading phone home technologies. But it's really, they're being really vague about that and people are really worried about that. So that's just one side of it. You know, there are a lot of issues, not just with the way they're doing this, but that it's a change. You know, for years they've been proudly the company that won't nickel and dime you. Right. I think there's a 2015 quote that, you know, there's no royalties, we're completely free, and that's what they've sold themselves on. And now, out of nowhere, if you're successful with a Unity game, you could end up paying a lot more than you budgeted for. And this will also apply to games that are currently out. Not previous installs, but future installs of current games, if that makes sense.
I mean, it. What you said makes sense. It doesn't make sense that that would right, be the case. Right. But
it's a little hard to understand where they're coming from here, especially for developers that have counted on this structure for years or might be in the middle of a project that they spent 2-3 years making. And now they're pretty much, you can't start over after that, but now you have a big line item for unexpected fees that Unity really gave no indication were coming.
Well, and I mean, you can't start over necessarily, or can you? I mean, there are some, you know, game developers who are saying, you know, and actually credit to John Ashley, who linked me to a page about Megacrit and Slay the Spire. And they're basically saying, sure, like, you know, we've invested an insane amount of time into this. We chose this platform for a reason. And now, you know, we're kind of facing the reality that if these changes that are about to occur aren't undone, like they're, you know, it sounds like they're basically going to give up on this and change course. And I'm pretty certain like they're not alone in that. Some, you know, some other developers are probably making pretty drastic decisions as well.
So there's quite a few developers I've heard from who are basically locked into Unity for the time being. They have to finish out, you know, their current project, because to start over again and rebuild from the ground up on a new engine would be too hard. But pretty much universally, everyone I've heard from is saying there is no way we will use Unity for our next project, and we can't recommend anyone else do, because even if you can afford this for a big project, like, you know, if you're selling, I don't know, a $20 game, even a 20 cent install fee is not going to break the bank. What it is, though, is kind of represents a breach of trust,
yes,
is what the developers are thinking. They went into this with one idea of what Unity was. They were paying a per site license just for the engine. They figured they could get that. Now, just changing it in midstream, Unity has erased all of that goodwill, and there's no guarantee that they won't change things again in the future. You know, so why would you use an engine like that if you don't have a partner that you don't feel will just take as much money as they can with new rules that they make up later?
Yeah. You know what, either fairly or unfairly comes to mind for me. I can't help but think about Google and as kind of a point of comparison when it comes to trust of a brand. And, you know, year after year, time after time, Google will roll out. And I guess Stadia is a great gaming related example of this. You know, Google puts out this thing to much ballyhoo, you know, within the company. We love this. We're behind it, you know, and they're hoping that everybody's going to buy into it and make it a success. And at some point they deem, you know, as any business has the right to do, they deem that, you know, this thing is not meeting our expectations as a business, as a company. And so it's undone. The downside to that is like what you're saying, it really impacts customer and developer trust in even going in that direction to begin with. I'm really curious to see like the level at which this threatens Unity's position in the gaming market and if they will undo it. Cause I mean, we've seen Google do that where they're like, okay, wait a minute, maybe we need to, you know, do about face. They don't do it very often, but could you see Unity doing that in this case?
Yeah, we'll see. The Stadia situation was a little different because I think if you bought a Stadia game, I think you had the understanding that, okay, maybe Google will not support this forever, especially if you were paying attention to the industry.
Yes.
With Unity, I feel like if you developed a Unity game, you know, 3 years ago or started on a game or put out a game, you had this feeling that, okay, Unity for years now, over a decade, has been this royalty-free company. That's their whole thing. They're going to keep that. And then all of a sudden, on a random Tuesday, they say, no, now you actually have to pay us starting next year for every install, even on games that were already released. So that's just an even bigger breach of trust than just, you know, getting rid of a product that didn't succeed. What it brings to mind for me, actually, I don't know if you remember at the beginning of the year, Hasbro, the makers of Dungeons and Dragons, tried to change the licensing terms for their products. You know, people who were making modules for the game would have to start paying some ridiculous licensing fee once they started making money. And there was a huge fan outcry about that. There were weeks of, you know, Wizards trying to backtrack, trying to ameliorate things. And finally, they just turned around and said, you know, we're going to totally turn this around. Forget we ever said anything. For Unity, I mean, that could happen. The game development community is that mad. It's very similar in that regard. The difference here is I'm not sure that Unity cares as much about those creators. What this is probably focused on is a few large, you know, free-to-play game makers or companies like Blizzard who have been, you know, using Unity and getting away very cheaply. And they want to get some revenue from those big guys. If that means that some smaller companies can no longer use Unity and are no longer paying, you know, a few site license fees and move on to another engine, they might not care as much if all they really care about is the bottom line.
That's a good point. Yeah, really good point. Somebody in our Discord actually just linked to a story posted yesterday about CEO Riccitiello. Is it Riccitiello? I'm probably mispronouncing his name, but how he sold, you know, around 50,000 shares this year of stock, obviously with this, you know, coming ahead. And I know that you mentioned in pre-show that you've been tracking a lot of the legal kind of ramifications of this. I don't know if you know anything about this particular story or if you've been looking into this, but kind of in your work, really, really scrutinizing the potential legal aspects of that. What's your take on where this goes from here?
Yeah, I want to be careful with the insider trading allegations. He's sold stock in the past, and apparently this recent stock sale was a very small part of his holdings. You know, it could be totally coincidental. Maybe he wanted money for a beach house or something. So, you know, I don't want to get into those motivations. Let the SEC do that. But as far as the legal issues, you know, it's kind of surprising to people that they're allowed to just change the rules midstream like this, right? If you put out a Unity game in 2019, you read their terms of service and you thought you had, you know, we're not charging fees. And you thought, oh, okay, that's what I'm expecting. And now to turn around and say, no, that game in 2019, now if people install it, and it reaches a certain threshold, we are going to charge you. Can they really just change the rules like that? As far as I can tell, I'm still looking at, you know, years of terms of service and updates and such, but it seems like they have a good case that they can. There's the clause in the terms of service that basically says we can, you know, change these fees, we can change these terms whenever we want. There are some conflicting things. There was a thing in 2019 where they said, we will always let you keep the old terms if you don't update the game, but then they got rid of that. So there might be some legal avenue there. It gets very complicated very quickly, and there probably will be some sort of court case over this, if I had to guess, some class action of developers who said, you know, you misrepresented this to us and it's going to cost us money.
Certainly.
I'm not sure how, on the legal route, I'm not sure how successful that will be. But, you know, beyond the legalities, it's really more about trust. When you're in business, you know, these contracts can protect you, but really you're in business with a company that you have to trust will treat you fairly and trust will be a good business partner. Now that they've made this move, I'm not sure a lot of developers are going to feel that way, no matter what the legal contract says.
Yeah, kind of poison the well at this point, as they say. Well, Kyle, always appreciate your work at Ars. I love the work that your entire team does, and I love following your reporting. This is a very detailed and, you know, scale and scope of this particular story. So thank you for writing it. Thank you for coming on and talk with us about it today, Kyle Orland at Ars Technica. If people want to follow you online, obviously they can find it on the site. If they want to follow you on like the socials, where can they find you?
I'm Kyle ORL on Blue Sky, which is where I do most of my posting. So hopefully you can get an invite.
Yeah, indeed. Right on, Kyle. Thank you so much and keep up the great work. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks. Talk to you later.
All right. Bye. All right. So it turns out that new car smell comes with a large amount of privacy trade-offs. So the good news, you got new car smell. The bad news, your privacy is destroyed, essentially. So that's coming up here in a moment. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by our friends at IT Pro TV. Now, ACI Learning. Our listeners know the name IT Pro TV as one of our trusted sponsors for the last decade. They've been on the network for so long. As part of ACI Learning, IT Pro TV, now IT Pro, has elevated their highly entertaining, bingeable, short format content with over 7,200 hours to choose from. New episodes added every single day. ACI Learning's personal account managers will be with you every step of the way, fortifying your expertise with access to self-paced IT training videos. You get interactive practice labs, certification practice tests, super helpful stuff. One user shares, excellent resource, not just for theory, but labs incorporated within the subscription. It's fantastic. Highly recommend the resource and top class instructors. And that's kind of the beauty of it. You're not just watching, you're participating, right? They have those labs and kind of work built into what you're watching. It's really helpful. Don't miss ACI Learning's practice labs where you can test and experiment before deploying new apps or updates without compromising your live system. MSPs, they love it. Retake practice IT certification tests so you're confident when you sit down for that actual exam. ACI Learning brings you IT practice exam questions from Microsoft, CompTIA, EC Council, PMI, and many more. And you can access every vendor and skill that you need to advance your IT career in one place. ACI Learning is the only official video training for CompTIA. Or you can check out their Microsoft IT training, their Cisco training, Linux training, Apple training, security, cloud, and the list goes on. Join ACI Learning on September 26th through the 27th here very soon in London at the International Cybersecurity and Cloud Expo to experience the latest innovations and cutting-edge technologies. So you can check them out there. Learn IT, pass your certs, get your dream job. Or if you're ready to bring your group along, you can head over to our special link and fill out the form for your team. TWIT listeners actually receive at least 20% off an IT Pro Enterprise solution and can reach up to 65% for volume discounts depending on the number of seats that you need. So learn more about ACI Learning's premium training options across audit, IT, and cybersecurity readiness. All you got to do is go to go.acilearning.com/twit. For individuals, use code TWIT30 for 30% off a standard or premium individual IT Pro membership. That's go.acilearning.com/twit. And we thank them so much for their continued support of Tech News Weekly and the Twit Network. All right, Micah, over to you.
Yeah, so it's very easy to look at this device that I have in front of me, or perhaps my phone, yeah, and say, you know what? There are a number of ways that this thing is tracking what I'm doing. I look at my browser and I think about how when I visit websites, it's looking at my behavior. It's paying attention to what sites I visit. And to be able to kind of reconcile that, to handle those privacy concerns in certain ways, and especially in the state of California, to be able to opt out of a lot of that stuff because of the protections that we have here, or if you're lucky enough to live in a place protected by GDPR, in some cases, even more privacy. But one place people might not be looking and should be looking is at the vehicle they're driving around. Joining us today to talk about the worst product category they've ever reviewed for privacy, it's the Mozilla Foundation's own Misha Rykov. Welcome back to the show, Misha.
Hello.
Hello, it's good to have you back. So I think it's important because I think the last time we had you was back in 2022. Could you start by telling us about the Mozilla Foundation's Privacy Not Included work, the work that you do, what it is, how you go about doing it, how it came about, and then tell us about what you call privacy dings.
Sure. So we started in 2017 as a consumer guide. We reviewed over this time, over 500 products, mainly connected things like cameras, the Alexa, and all things like Google connected things. But last year, we looked also a lot into the apps. What we do, we look through all the privacy documentations. We also do some privacy and security checks. And we ask three main questions. One is what data is collected and what's done with it. Is it being shared? Is it being sold? Second question, what can users do about it? Can they opt out or can they delete data collected about them? And third, what is the known track record of this particular things? Yeah, have we seen a lot of data leaks in the past, like we see with Facebook? Or was it a decent and nothing bad happened so far? On top of this privacy questions, we also check the minimum security standards. So we check if the product has encryption, a strong password, does it push updates, does it have some vulnerability management in place, ideally bug bounty, and if the privacy policy is in place. Since 2 years, we look also at AI. We only start looking into it. It's really hard to access AI trustworthiness of anything because we don't have many documents about it. But actually, in case of vehicles and in case of last year's mental health apps, reproductive health apps, we already started assessing based on the news articles, based on the feedback from the users, if AI is trustworthy or not. And we could already this year already put some dings on the AI as well. Mm-hmm. So talking about dings, if we see that a product is not meeting any of these points that I just mentioned, we give it a ding. And if it has 2 out of 3 privacy ding, or if it has a security ding, then we put an overall ding. And this year, we looked at 25 car brands, and all of them earned our ding. So all of them are either bad or very bad in terms of users' privacy.
Understood. Okay. So with the dings figured out and kind of the understanding of the guide, this is what really stuck out for me in this latest research that you did, because I'd argue that folks don't really think of cars necessarily when they're thinking about tech privacy and security. Certainly they look at the review guides and look at the safety concerns for the vehicle. They look at the mileage for the vehicle. They look at if it's an electric vehicle, the range for the vehicle. But this is a category that I would argue kind of flies under the radar. So what led the team to actually set their sights on the automotive industry? Like, who had that thought in the first place that, oh, this is somewhere where we should be looking?
So we have heard some rumors just on the internet, but also from some of people who drive cars from different directions. It didn't come for me because I live in Europe and I just bike around. I would never think. I'm more concerned about e-bikes and scooters here. But some of the some of my colleagues in the US told us that after she bought a car, the dealer kind of forced her to download an app, and without it, she would not like he would not sign some paper. Wow. Another thing we have heard from one of our colleagues is that he rented a car and then he connected his phone to the car, and then the smart car started in the line of like, okay, like we now like downloaded something from your phone. And then like he shared it with us and we looked on the web, and indeed there were a lot of stories how people just lease a car for 1 week, maybe going on vacation. And then later in this car were found their SMS, their pictures, their contact lists. And then we realized that actually car can have much more data than a phone. And on top of it, it has a lot of sensors, it has cameras, and it has telematic devices, all kind of third party things on it. And also you connect it to a lot of apps. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So sometimes you have app from your car manufacturer, and you also use a lot of entertainment apps or people use navigation apps, and all of this looks like a big soup. Add on top of it insurances, pay as you go, add on top of it Wi-Fi services or like network services that exist, add their huge data broker industry that is happy to buy the data and sell it, this data. And then, yeah, we got really, really curious about what's going on there.
Understood. So then let's talk about, you did briefly mention this, the kind of data that car brands are collecting on us. So you talked about kind of where they're collecting the data. Let's talk about what data is being collected, because, you know, someone might go, wait, I just thought they knew how fast I was driving, or perhaps if I'm putting in my location into the maps, then they know where I'm going. But according to this guide, they're gathering a lot more, and some of them are gathering some categories you might not expect.
Yes. So again, like what we can assess is what they write. So we can only access by trusting them. Mm-hmm. But also if they mention something, we don't know if they actually collected. So based on the privacy documentation that these companies published themselves, we are just shocked by the amount and by different types of data being collected there. So it starts with the obvious stuff, with stuff that they say they collect for safety, such things like speed, acceleration, location, how much you use brakes and when. So how you'd open your like window glass, some simple things. Then it moves on to more creepy things like recordings of the sound of what's going on in the car, and video recording or other sensor recordings. And then we saw, like, in a lot of cases, that they can also collect things like gender, race, immigration status, and then it goes creepy with some mentioning information which is genetical or information about sex life.
Wow.
yes.
Wow.
Here we are.
It leaves you wondering if they have to put that in the privacy policy, how are they going about collecting that kind of information? It almost makes you not want to touch the steering wheel. Like, is it gathering my DNA every time I touch my steering wheel? How does it have genetic information on me? And it's more so what kind of like a, I guess to use a pun here, a drive-by situation where in your normal interactions with the vehicle, if they happen to gain that information based on your behavior, then they could make those inferences about sex life or genetic information. I mean, how does me buying a Kia result in them potentially having genetic information on me? Or is it just kind of, they're just laying it all out there just
covering
in case.
Their tracks.
Yeah. In case we happen to scoop up your saliva while you're driving around.
You never know.
Yeah. You never know. What is your thought on those specific categories that just seem like they should never know that in my car?
I don't know. And that's exactly the problem. So me and my colleagues spent 600 hours looking through the mass of myriads of different documents these companies put out there. And then the question is, how can a user possibly understand what data collected, why, how, and for what purpose? And it's becoming even harder when you try to get location-specific answers, like, what if I'm located in California? What about me being in Vermont? What if I'm in India or I'm in France? Like we could not find also that stuff. So all we know is that some companies, and it's Kia and it's also Nissan, say that they may collect sex life data or like sexual information. We don't know what it means. I would be very curious myself. We don't know how exactly, but like technically it might be possible through the sensors and cameras and of course audio that's there. And legally it's possible that their legal department just copy-pasted all things that are even possible to be collected and then pasted there just in case.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Wow. So many of the largest online sites and services offer ways for users to opt out of data collection and in some cases delete personal data that gets hoovered up by them. We've got cookie notices. We've got GDPR banners. We've got in California banners that let us click a button that says do not sell my personal information. Do these car brands offer the same? Can I tell Kia to stop listening to the sounds I make in my vehicle?
So many do, yes. Many offer some ways to opt out from selling data or to opt out from targeted advertisement or some others say that they only do it with your consent. The issue here, once some data has been collected, you lost control over it already. So deleting data in general is a hard thing to do. With this 25 brands, only with one, and this is French Renault, we could prove that they really respect the request to delete data with any user, regardless of where they are. Everyone else only promises it to people who are in Europe or to people who are in California, Colorado. My colleague who has a Mazda asked Mazda, okay, what data do you have on me? And they answered, we don't have to answer because you're in Vermont. You're not actually based. You're not covered by the CCPA. So she was not even able to know what data has been collected on her, yet alone deleted. So we also expect these opt-outs to be tricky things. And finally, we stand strongly with the position that this should not be opt-out, this should be opt-in thing. So users should have the right of informed decision about it. At least it should be standard, like we see with the cookies on the web. Yeah, this annoying pop-up asking you, are you okay with us collecting cookies? And then you can answer no. This is also like manipulative and annoying thing, but at least you get asked and you see that you get asked. In case of cars, they don't ask you. They just automatically collect, sell, target you with ads. And if you want to do an opt out, it's really good luck to try find how to do it. Good luck trying to to actually submit this request. And then, yeah, it might be tricky again if you're not in California, for example.
Yeah. So we'll kind of wrap things up here pretty quick. I would ask you to tell us the car brands that were included in the guide, but there are 25 of them. And of course, folks need to head over and check out the Privacy Not Included guide on this to learn more. Not only do you get kind of an overview, but you also get individual reviews of these car brands. So I was hoping, though, you could tell us maybe the top three worst offenders, and then maybe what was the, like, most glaring bit of discovery that you had when you were looking at these car brands, along with the sexual activity, for example. Why did the worst offender rank so poorly as the worst offender? So yeah, top three, and then kind of what made the worst one the worst.
Mm-hmm. It is not easy. Like, a lot of them are really bad. So now you're showing how they're sorted from best to worst. I would say that the worst like group will probably include Kia and Nissan, mm-hmm. and also GM, Ford, Lincoln, because they collect sex data, sexual orientation data or like genetical data, and on top of it we could not confirm with any of those if they encrypt data that sits on the car. Whoa. And on top of it they all have track record of huge data leaks, or that would affect usually millions of users. We are talking about sometimes these databases popping up on the dark web with names and social security numbers and addresses of people who use these cars.
So I just want to double down on that. You're saying that with those brands, you were not able to confirm that the data they're collecting, this private information and you know, secure information, should be, you're saying that data they're collecting, you could not confirm that they are encrypting it. And so given that they may not be encrypting it, they are also, some of the most likely to be brands that have sort of had their data leaked in the dark web. So on top of, potentially not encrypting the data, they also are the victims of massive data breaches. So you have 1 + 1 = 2 in the case that unencrypted data may potentially be getting leaked with some regularity to the dark web. And that, of course, yeah, that would make you one of the worst offenders on the list.
Yeah, it does. It does indeed looks like 1 + 1 = 2. So when I talk encryption here, I'm talking about encryption at the car. So with most of car brands, we could not confirm it. This being said, it's a difficult technical task. And it looks like only Tesla really took it seriously, because like they did engage people offering them huge money if they hack the car. Mm-hmm. Tesla still got a lot of dings. It's not the best at all, mm-hmm. but they kind of pushed hard this encryption on the car thing. Everyone else encrypts something and don't encrypt something. So that's a problem because it means that individual cars can be hacked easily. On top of it, when I talk data breach at scale, it means that the databases that are sitting somewhere there in the cloud with data on millions of people, they are also vulnerable to the attacks because we see often some malware going on or, again, these databases being leaked to dark web. Understood. So we are talking about weak security both on the car and on the database level, be it cloud or some physical data center, whatever they have, mm-hmm. it looks to be weak.
Understood. The last thing I'll ask you here, because this does leave me feeling a little bit hopeless. Is there anything that car owners can do to protect their privacy and their online security? Like, what's the recommendation at this point, other than to bike instead of drive a car?
Well, we invite everyone to sign up a petition on our web page. We are also preparing Crown to ask for the federal privacy law so that not only people based in California, but everyone in the US can have similar protection like all Europeans have it covered by GDPR. But if you just have a car now, we would suggest you to do opt-outs from selling your data. We would suggest you opt out from targeted ads of your data and maybe go to our page and take a look at what's written about your car, and we give their individual tips about it.
Oh, wonderful. Excellent. Misha, I want to thank you so much for your time today, for the time that you and your colleagues spent 600 hours working through all of this information. I think it's incredible what the Mozilla Foundation is doing in terms of doing the hard labor to protect all of us. Of course, they can head over to foundation.mozilla.org. We'll have a direct link to the Privacy Not Included guide. But is there anywhere where folks can go to follow you online to keep up with what you're doing?
The best is to go to privacynotincluded.org.
Oh, excellent. All right. Yeah, that's a much easier URL. Thank you so much. I'm sure we'll have you back on the show in the future for the next round of whatever you happen to be looking at. And keep up the great work, and we'll see you soon.
Thank you.
All righty, folks. Up next, we have Jason Howell's story of the week, all about kind of a really big cyber attack. We don't see this too often, but actually kind of playing ball with the hackers. And you hear that, what is that phrase? We don't negotiate with terrorists.
Right.
But occasionally that can happen. We will be back with that story of the week, but I do want to take a quick break to tell you about one of our sponsors today. It's ExpressVPN, who are bringing you this episode of Tech News Weekly. I'm curious, have you ever browsed in incognito mode? Well, keep in mind that it's probably not as incognito as you think. Incognito mode, like the Chrome browser itself, is a Google product, and Google has made its fortune by tracking your movements online. Huh, my story of the week has to do with that, actually. There's even a $5 billion class action lawsuit against the company in California, where it's accused of secretly collecting user data. What's Google's defense? Incognito does not mean invisible. So how do you actually make yourself as invisible as possible online? Well, with ExpressVPN. It's what I use. Even in incognito mode, your online activity still gets tracked without something like ExpressVPN, and data brokers can still buy and sell your data. One of the data points they use is your IP address. Data harvesters can use your IP address to uniquely identify you and your location. But with ExpressVPN, your connection gets rerouted through an encrypted server and your IP address is masked. You become one of many in this huge group that is all using one IP address. Every time you connect to ExpressVPN, you're given a random IP address shared by other ExpressVPN customers. That makes it more difficult for third parties to identify you and harvest your data because your behavior is masked by the behavior of many others. And the best part is how easy ExpressVPN is to use. No matter what device you're on, phone, your laptop, your smart TV, all you have to do is tap one button for instant protection. I use ExpressVPN everywhere. And what's great about it is I often forget I have it turned on because it's fast. A lot of times, at least in the past, I can remember activating VPNs and knowing, okay, we're going to return to dial-up speeds here. That is not something that I experienced with ExpressVPN. It was so easy to install, so easy to get started, so easy to use. And I have to say, I'm looking forward to the next version of tvOS, the operating system for the Apple TV, because they're finally bringing VPN app support to Apple TV. So as soon as that's ready with ExpressVPN, I'll be able to turn that on right there on the Apple TV and have VPN support there, which is handy when occasionally I want to travel to other countries so that I can watch content that is only available in other countries. So if you really want to go incognito and protect your privacy, secure yourself with the number one rated VPN. Visit expressvpn.com/TNW and get 3 extra months free with a 1-year package. That's expressvpn.com/TNW. Go to expressvpn.com/TNW to learn more. And of course, our thanks to ExpressVPN for sponsoring this week's episode of Tech News Weekly. All right, we are back from the break, and that means it's time for your story of the week.
I'm going to do my best Steve Gibson impression for this story.
Okay.
No, actually, I'm not going to do any sort of impression. Guarantee you, Steve Gibson is going to be talking about this story next week on Security Now. So definitely check that out, twit.tv/SN. But MGM resorts, not just in Vegas, but around the country, around the U.S., were shut down, still in certain ways are shut down as a result of a major ransomware attack. At first, it was kind of unconfirmed, but now we're kind of getting more information today that it did indeed happen. It's the most notable hotels when you're in Las Vegas. So that's Bellagio, Mandalay Bay, the Cosmopolitan, also 6 other hotels around the country, all impacted by this ransomware attack, taking down all sorts of things. This was first detected Sunday in the evening, and the attack was executed by social engineering, of course, mm-hmm. because that's always, we say it so often on this network. And I know on Security Now as well, social engineering is just such an Achilles heel when it comes to keeping places secure and keeping security, running smoothly. In this case, it was social engineering that allowed for the attackers to identify an MGM employee who worked in IT support. And that happened via LinkedIn. And then they called the MGM help desk with that information. And through that, we're somehow able to get access. Total attack time, reportedly 10 minutes of time.
Humans are ultimately the vulnerability
time. Right? You have to imagine groups that do this, and especially at this level, like they're really good at the social game, like mm-hmm. getting on the phone with someone, like they know how to talk the talk as far as that's concerned. This is a company that's valued at $34 billion and took 10 minutes to do this. Executed by a ransomware as a service group called ALPHV. And this resulted in, I actually first heard about this from my sister. She was, she and her husband have a solar company and they were there for a solar convention. And I just happened to call and she's like, yeah, it's really weird here. Like we're staying at one of the MGM hotels and everything is just dead silent because, the rooms were locked. So hotel guests were getting locked out of their rooms because their cards didn't work. Digital key cards inoperable. So that made charging of goods and services unavailable. Wow. The mobile app was disabled and actually still is disabled today. Here we are at the end of the week. So the hotels were, you know, resorting to running transactions manually, which you imagine with the numbers that they're dealing with, just how much of a nightmare that probably is. Check-ins taking hours to complete, slot machines completely unavailable. That was one thing my sister mentioned. She's like walking through the room. It's just like, it's so eerie. Like you're used to these, the sounds of slot machines everywhere and it's nothing. It's just like dead silent.
That's almost enough for me to like celebrate. Because that means people weren't just losing their money.
Totally,
for
right?
For at least a few hours.
Well, for at least a few hours. Well, you know, they were probably going to another place.
Dang it, you're right.
And that's what she was saying. She was like, it's dead here. I mean, people obviously realize like they can't spend their money on these slot machines, so they're going somewhere else. As of yesterday, the MGM Resorts website had been down for more than 84 hours. Is it still down? MGM Resorts. I haven't visited it today, but I have a feeling, yeah, it's still down. So, I mean, you know, pretty severe impact on a company worth an insane amount of money. The FBI and MGM have been pretty mum on the details of the breach. But it does appear that MGM is not giving in to the ransomware payment demands. That's actually news as of this morning. What's interesting also about this is like this is not the only thing of this nature that's happened in the last handful of weeks. Weeks ago, Caesars Entertainment had its own cyber attack.
Wow.
Data stolen, threatened to be released. The hackers, in that case, successfully extorted money from Caesars. And the Wall Street Journal just reported that Caesars paid a $30 million ransom in order to do it. So the two different organizations taking completely different approaches, right?
Yeah.
And the risks associated with paying versus
And it's
not.
My understanding that federal groups are against the pay because then it does make it a valuable thing.
Yep.
And so there's been even kind of trouble with insurance companies offering insurance for cyber attacks in the US because the federal groups don't want those insurance companies to pay out to the ransomware attackers because then it potentially encourages others to be able to do the same.
Yep.
So I'm surprised that Caesars, you know, was I guess allowed to do that, or if they chose to do that without consult. I don't know how that all works.
I don't know how that works either. Are they actually beholden to?
Right. Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, it is their money.
It's their money and their company. Yeah.
Right.
So yeah, that could be the difference. Maybe if it's a government body that gets ransomware, they aren't allowed to pay or something. But then I'm also curious. You said it was a ransomware as a service group that did it.
Yeah.
Did the ransomware as a service group, so the company that makes the group that makes the ransomware for sale, actually do this attack as sort of a case study to sell their product? Or did someone buy the ransomware as a service product and then execute this attack?
Yeah, that's a really great, great question. I'm guessing the latter, not the former, but you know, again, there's still not a lot of information that they're being
that's kind of the whole point
forthcoming about.
Yeah.
Because I imagine, you know, the more information that's out there, the more difficult it is for them to kind of, seal up and control what's going on right now. But yeah, pretty major stuff impacting a heck of a lot of money and just kind of. You just don't see that very often to shut down that much of Vegas, just as one example, you know.
And I mean, it's chilling.
I feel like it's a movie.
It does feel like a movie plot. And I think it's relatively low stakes. The company itself doesn't feel that way, I'm sure.
Sure.
But it's low stakes in terms of sort of public safety. And so what's chilling to me about this is the fact that they're able to shut down that robust network that by doing that, they had the app, they had the website, they had the keys, they had the slot machine, like they had everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so think about them doing that to a power supply, a water purification plant. What's chilling
about it.
Stakes
are just much higher. Yeah. And I mean, to kind of, you know, wheel back to kind of MGM, like, that's scary stuff for sure. As far as MGM's business, like it's also interesting to kind of see how this impacts. Oh, it actually kind of ties in with the Unity conversation from earlier. Kind of customer trust. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you are someone who goes to Vegas, who stays at MGM Resorts, and then, you know, you just happen to go during this time and you can't do what you normally go there to do, you know, does that impact your trust of that brand going forward? Like, there's going to be some, I think I've read some, you know, articles that say a very material impact, long-term material impact for MGM.
We're not saying that MGM place, we're going to go somewhere else.
Yeah, right. Know?
Yeah.
Right.
They can't protect themselves. So we don't, or, and maybe they don't even know as far as that goes. So like,
yeah,
we were there and I couldn't,
we were
be on the slot machine.
Yes.
So exactly. I'm going to go somewhere else from now on.
I couldn't put my money in that machine and watch it go away.
The place that I went to with the fire alarms going off every night at midnight and 4 a.m., I don't want to go to another one of those properties again.
Yeah, right.
And it's not really their fault. If it was a malfunction, then yes. But what I believe it to be, which was somebody being a jerk and going around and pulling it. But it's still like left a bad taste in my mouth
for sure,
as far as place goes. So something as bad as all of that.
Yeah.
Ugh, waiting hours to be able to check in. People don't like to be inconvenienced.
So, yeah. No way. So interesting stuff. Like I said, surely Steve Gibson's going to be talking about this, because I'm sure we're going to learn more over the weekend, more details about kind of what's actually going on here. And Steve would probably have a very good explanation as far as,
absolutely,
like, you know, ransomware as a service. Yeah. Who is actually the perpetrator as far as that's concerned?
And, yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing about it.
Yeah. All right. Coming up next, another story that I considered for my story of the week, which is the Google antitrust trial. And so Mike is going to talk a little bit about that. But first, let's take a break. Thank the sponsor of this episode of Tech News Weekly, and that is Drata. Is your organization finding it difficult to collect manual evidence and achieve continuous compliance as it's growing and scaling? Well, as a leader in cloud compliance software by G2, Drata streamlines your SOC 2, your ISO 27001, your PCI DSS, GDPR, HIPAA, and other compliance frameworks, while providing 24-hour continuous control monitoring so you can focus on scaling securely. With a suite of more than 75 integrations, Drata easily integrates through applications like AWS, Azure, GitHub, Okta, and Cloudflare. Countless security professionals from companies including Lemonade, Notion, and Bamboo HR have shared how crucial it's been to have Drata as a trusted partner in the compliance process. So you can expand security assurance efforts like they did using the Drata platform, which allows companies to see all of their controls and easily map them to compliance frameworks to gain immediate insight into framework overlap. Drata's automated dynamic policy templates support companies new to compliance using integrated security awareness training programs, and automated reminders ensure smooth employee onboarding. As the only player in the industry to build on a private database architecture, your data can never be accessed by anyone outside your organization. All customers receive a team of compliance experts, including a designated customer success manager. And Drata's team of former auditors has conducted more than 500 audits, so they know what they're doing. Your Drata team keeps you on track to ensure that there are no surprises, no barriers. Plus, Drata's pre-audit calls prepare you for when your audits actually begin. Drata's Audit Hub is the solution to faster, more efficient audits. You can save hours of back and forth communication, never misplacing crucial evidence, and you can share documentation instantly. All interactions and data gathering can occur in Drata between you and your auditor, so you won't actually have to switch between different tools or correspondence strategies either. With Drata's risk management solution, you can manage end-to-end risk assessment and treatment workflows. So you're flagging risks, scoring them, and then you can decide whether to accept, to mitigate, transfer, or avoid them. Drata maps appropriate controls to risks. That simplifies risk management and automates the process. Drata's Trust Center provides real-time transparency into security and compliance posture, which improves sales, security reviews, and better relationships with customers and partners, which is very nice and important. So say goodbye to manual evidence collection. Say hello to automated compliance by visiting Drata.com drata.com/twit. That's drata.com/twit, bringing automation to compliance at Drata speed. And we thank Drata for their support of Tech News Weekly. All right. This is a big week for Google when it comes to this whole antitrust, you know, threat, the threat of going to court and changing, you know, really upending potentially Google's business.
It's been more than 20 years since we last saw big tech at the forefront of something, sort of facing off with the federal government at this level. More than 20 years ago, the federal government looked at Microsoft as a potential monopoly. And that was a messy, messy, messy time where lots of money was spent and perhaps not all eyes were. It's interesting, more than 20 years later, how the landscape of like of reporting has changed too. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's more opportunity for more eyes to be on this. The U.S. Justice Department plus 38 states and territories have kicked off as of Monday, September 12th. No, that's Tuesday, September 12th, isn't
Tuesday,
it?
Yeah.
Yeah, Tuesday, September 12th, a 10-week trial with Google. They're trying to see if Google has basically used its place in the marketplace and the agreements that it's made to do what they call, quote, monopolist flexing.
They're so buff.
They're looking at Google's different tactics and seeing if any of what it's done has been illegal as a way to keep its search monopoly. So this is specifically about its search monopoly. Now, one of the big concerns here is the fact, and we've known this for a long time, that Google pays Apple quite a bit of money in order to be the default search provider on iPhones. And so what happens there is when I use Safari on my phone, which is the browser that most people are going to use on their iPhones, and I type something into the bar at the top, it's going to use Google as the search engine to do that. I have the option to go into my phone and choose a different search engine, but most people do not opt to do so. And so how much does Google pay Apple to keep that default search engine provider? $10 billion annually. Mm-hmm. I talked about this yesterday. Well, I should say we talked about this yesterday on Windows Weekly with Richard Campbell and Paul Thurrott. And one thing that Paul said is what that tells us is that Google is making at least $10 billion on this deal to be the default search engine provider. They to pay $10 billion, they have to at least be making $10 billion a year to be able to do that. Otherwise, they would not do that. Because what it results in is when I do a search, and as I'm looking through my Google search results, I'm getting the ads that are included in that, although I'm not because I have different stuff in place to keep me from seeing ads. But the average person is seeing ads. And so the company is making money off of serving up those ads. And when you consider how many iPhones are out in the world and other Apple devices, that results in a lot of income for Google. So it happily hands over $10 billion annually. But the government doesn't like that, does not like the idea of Google paying money to get that default search engine provider on its own operating system, Android. It is going to be the default search engine provider. And so when you look at that, then suddenly, if you've got Android and you've got iOS and Google gets to be the search engine on both of those, that's the swath of all of the stuff out there. So, you know, maybe there's something to this is what I'm saying. I'm no lawyer. I don't even play one on TV, but arguably there's something there. Google or the government is going, look, these seem to be a way that Google is not only kind of solidifying its dominance as the search engine of choice, but also to eliminate rivals. Any search engine that tries to come along and compete doesn't seem to be able to compete because most people don't know to go in and change their search engine. And I would argue that in the cases where people have maybe dabbled with other search engines, it ends up not being that great. So
yeah, I think that's a really important point.
Yeah. So that critical. Too is like, see, then that's why this isn't, I think, just an open and shut case, right?
Because no, there's
an argument here that if you make the best thing, that's the whole point of you know,
yeah,
anti-monopoly stuff is, or not anti-monopoly stuff, but the capitalism is, if you make the best product, then you should be the you know, the one that makes the most money. And that competition is what's supposed to result in that. Now, again, we haven't seen anything like this in so long. And when the Microsoft thing happened, it did have a huge impact on the industry at the time. But the industry has changed so much in more than 20 years that we're looking at this as a whole new kind of... we can't look back to that too much as a determining factor for what the impact is going to be. Mm-hmm. And there are kind of two outcomes here. The government wins and big tech is going to start cowering. It's going to have to start cowering a little bit because it's seeing that in a modern world and a new way of the internet and with modern technology that the federal government can make an argument that holds that big tech needs to watch itself. Or if Google wins, then this could be precedent set for all of the other bills, all of the other laws that are in place that are trying to limit big tech. Mm. So it's a gamble for the federal government in one way, because if it loses, then this focus on big tech and trying to kind of rein in some of the powers there could drive could be harmed. But if they win, then this is the first of what we could probably see many instances of regulations and laws going forward. There are other lawsuits against Google itself, Meta, which is Facebook's parent company, Amazon and Apple that are kind of under consideration. So the federal government is not just looking at Google. This is just kind of the first one that's kicked off. And again, most of this surrounds Google outside of its own ecosystem, choosing to make it working to make itself the default search engine provider. Now, that said, Google's big argument is that in the modern web, Googling is only one type of searching content. They argue, for example, that when you go to Amazon, you don't Google search on Amazon. You use Amazon search to find products. Mm-hmm. When you go to Instacart, you don't Google search to find the groceries. You use Instacart's own search engine. When you go to TikTok, you don't have to search at all. It'll just pop up for you. But if you do search there, yeah, that's TikTok. So it's saying, look, we're just one of many search engines that people are using these days. We're just that old school search engine. How do you do, fellow kids? We're just that old school search engine just existing in this modern place where there are so many ways that people search for stuff.
I totally agree with that.
So it's sounding to me like you feel that Google... Well, I'll just ask you, how are you feeling about this? Yeah. Where do you stand on this?
We talked about this a little bit yesterday on This Week in Google. It was kind of at the top of the story heap because, mm-hmm, you know, it is big news and it's been a long time coming. And I think for the most part, we were all kind of in agreement that, I mean, when it comes to a search product, there is competition. It does exist. People do have a choice, and Google's product is the best. Yeah. I mean, in our opinion, yeah, but I think resoundingly that is, you know, more likely people are going to agree with that statement than others. If you're a business, you're working to create a product that is the best in its category. There's nothing criminal about that.
Correct.
If Google is doing something that eliminates, you know, others and, you know, eliminates their ability to compete, I mean, that is the essence of what we're talking here. That's a problem. But I mean, when you're talking about like Google search on iPhone, this is a deal that Apple has agreed to. Mm-hmm. and Google's, you know, paying them money. I guess it just kind of falls apart. Like, there's a whole lot of for something that makes for antitrust to be all about like a lack of choice. I feel like there's a lot of choice.
Yeah. I mean, literally on my phone, I can choose between the five. It's just what is chosen by default.
Yeah, sure.
And it's almost like we are saying that sometimes this stuff feels so cynical because I think that it treats human beings or it assumes stupidity in human beings almost.
Right. Yeah.
And it's like, because it's the default search engine, a stupid, dumb human isn't going to know that they can. And that's kind of cynical and mm-hmm. I don't know. I think we're more sophisticated than that. Behaviorally, yes, you often don't make that choice to change, but the choice is still provided.
Yeah, it's there. It's been provided. Do you choose to use it? Is it being buried? Like, is it being intentionally buried so that people don't do it?
Microsoft has done some of that in the past.
Yeah.
And even in the modern way of doing things, where it was very hard to change your default browser on Windows, and then they straightened up and flew right after a while.
Yeah, yeah.
That, I argue, is. But this setting has been in the same place for as long as I can remember, the same place to go to get it. Yeah. I would say this. I think that it wouldn't be a bad idea for Google to stop paying Apple $10 billion to be the default search engine and then let Apple handle the way that it does that going forward. Mm-hmm. I think that that could be the one concession that it makes. And then all the rest of it, I'm just 100% on board with, like, they're making the best thing. It does the best searches. It's good at what it does.
And there are other ways to do this sort of thing. Yeah. Like Google, a search engine is no longer the only, you know, the be all end all as far as this is concerned.
The number of times that it talks about that Apple deal leads me to believe that that's their biggest issue. And so if they get rid of that, then and then it's just Apple's choice. Does Apple, even though they're not getting, it's not getting paid anymore, does it keep just Google as the default search engine?
Right. Does Apple have a
setup option where you choose? Mm-hmm. And this was something that Paul Thurrott pointed out that I thought was really important, is that what happens if Apple defaults then to another, another search engine. So let's say DuckDuckGo, just for example, mm-hmm. or Bing even. Let's go with Bing. And the story suddenly becomes, for the first time in the history of iOS, people know how to change their default search engine because they're all changing it to Google. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
right.
Like that becomes the story, that people suddenly, the most searched term on Google is how to switch to Google search. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And that would be a PR nightmare for any search engine that is, you know, other than Google, because I think that people would end up going and switching it to, they'd see the search results from the other thing.
They would more likely,
like,
do
what
that.
Is this? Yeah. This doesn't work. I want what I had before.
Wait a minute,
where'd
it go?
Yeah. I will say this too, though. Google on my iPhone has gotten a lot worse in helping me find what I'm looking for.
Yeah.
In recent months, it's not even been in recent years, in recent months, it's becoming like a recipe blog on a website where there are 9 pages of stuff you don't need before you get the actual search result. And I don't know what that's all about, but it's like trying to be smart. And then as you keep scrolling, then it's like, maybe you want to search for terms relative to this. No, I don't. I just want what I was looking for. So that's been kind of frustrating.
Mm-hmm. Have you dabbled at all with the AI search experience at all?
No, I think it's because it's just like Siri. Siri disappointed me one too many times in the early days, and so I hardly ever use Siri anymore.
Yeah.
But Google Bard searchy stuff has just been not good. Was not good for me enough that I don't have the time to mess around with it. I don't want to. Although I did just get access to the Notebooks ML system. So I am looking forward to trying that out.
Yeah.
But
super interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. Well, I mean, you said it was a, you know, a 10-week trial ish, somewhere around 10 there.
10-week trial plus all of the years of back and forths that I'm sure to come afterwards.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, this is nowhere. Yeah, we are nowhere near the end. We're at the beginning of the trial, but it's not like 10 weeks from now it's all done. Yeah. Like, you know, this is also, you know, part of the big swirl of, you know, cracking down on big tech.
Yep.
And this is just one of many.
I'm sure we're going to see many more cases in the next couple of years, for
indeed.
Sure.
Indeed. All right. And we will talk about it here on Tech News Weekly when that happens. Twit.tv/TNW. We do the show every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. You can actually watch us live if you like, twit.tv/live. But even if you do that, please subscribe. Go to twit.tv/TNW. You'll find all the ways to subscribe to this show. That's really the most important part for us, is that you subscribe and you get it automatically. So thank you for doing that.
Also, if you'd like to get all of our shows ad-free, including this very show, Tech News Weekly, consider checking out Club Twit. Starting at $7 a month or $84 a year, you out there can join the club at twit.tv/clubtwit. And when you do, you get some pretty great things. First, you get every single Twit show with no ads, just the content, because you, in effect, are supporting the show. So you get to just listen to the content itself. You also gain access to the members-only Twit Plus bonus feed that has extra content you won't find anywhere else. Behind the scenes, before the show, after the show, special Club Twit events get published there. So if you're considering joining the club just now, you will be happy to hear that there's going to be lots of stuff in that feed for you to check out, a huge back catalog. Plus, you gain access to the members-only Discord server, fun place to go to chat with your fellow Club Twit members and also those of us here at Twit. It's a lot of fun to hang out there. Lots of different topics, great live chat, and everything in between. Again, all at twit.tv/clubtwit. I say starting at $7 a month. It's not a tiered subscription where you get more if you pay more, but rather that we heard from some folks who said, hey, we'd like to give you more money because you keep adding things to the club. It's more valuable. So we want to be able to give you more money. So if you pay $7, if you pay more than $7, you will get access to all that great stuff. You also will gain access to some Club Twit exclusive shows. There's the Untitled Linux Show, which is a show all about Linux. There's also Hands on Windows, a program from Paul Thurrott that covers Windows tips and tricks, and my own show, Hands on Mac, which covers Apple tips and tricks. Plus, we've got the program from Scott Wilkinson. It's Home Theater Geeks, which is relaunched in the club, covering all sorts of home theater topics, gizmos, gadgets, tips, tricks, and everything in between. And a new show from Jason Howell, all about artificial intelligence. If you would like, that's at twit.tv/clubtwit. Head there, sign up, and we thank you for helping to keep what we do going. It is through those generous contributions that we can continue to do what we do. If you would like to follow me online or check out the work that I'm doing, you can follow me on many a social media network at Micah Sargent, or head to chihuahua.coffee. That's chihuahua.coffee, where I've got links to the places I'm most active online. Check out later today, if you're a Club Twit member, Hands on Mac. You can check out on Sunday, Ask the Tech Guys. Leo Laporte will be back and will be answering your questions live on air. And on Tuesdays, you can watch iOS Today with Rosemary Orchard and yours truly, where we cover all things iOS. And if you got time this Saturday at 3 p.m. Pacific, I am running a D&D live stream. It's a high-level game that is going to raise money for St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. The donations that you make will actually impact the game, so you can give some of the players like potions and items. And if you want to really make them squirm, you can summon monsters. And all of this money goes to St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. So that starts at 3 p.m. Pacific at twitch.tv/relayfm. Nice. So consider tuning in then. Jason Howell, tell us about you.
Good stuff. Yes, I am working on an AI show with Jeff Jarvis. think we've landed on the title AI Inside. And that is going to be in the club for now, twit.tv/clubtwit. But you can actually, if you're not in the club and you want to watch it being recorded, you can check out the live stream. We're going to be live streaming that. So that happens every Thursday at 1 p.m. Pacific. You can find me at Jason Howell on Twitter. You can find me twit.social/@JasonHowell on Mastodon. Really just go to your social network and do a search for Jason Howell and you'll probably find my account. Hopefully you don't find my doppelganger.
What is your username on Instagram? Specifically your username on Instagram.
My username on Instagram is that Jason Howell. Just that Jason Howell. No punctuation.
Nothing. Yes. No other letters. Just absolutely that Jason Howell.
Important to know that you're actually talking to me. That's all I'm going to say. That Jason Howell on Instagram. Thank you, everyone here in the studio for helping us do this show. John Burke in the other room. Ant sometimes helps out. Thank you so much. We couldn't do it without you. And we couldn't do it without you at home watching and listening. So thank you for watching and listening. We'll see you next time on Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.
Goodbye.
Hey, I'm Rod Pyle, Editor-in-Chief of Ad Astra Magazine, and each week I join with my co-host to bring you This Week in Space, the latest and greatest news from the final frontier. We talk to NASA chiefs, space scientists, engineers, educators, and artists, and sometimes we just shoot the breeze over what's hot and what's not in space books and TV. And we do it all for you, our fellow true believers. So whether you're an armchair adventurer or waiting for your turn to grab a slot in Elon's Mars rocket, join us on This Week in Space and be part of the greatest adventure of all time.
Mother's Day is almost here, and you can get her the most beautiful time-tested gift around. A watch she can wear every day for Movement. Whether mom's into classic dress watches, rare and refined ceramics, or tried-and-true bestsellers, Movement has something she'll love. And right now, you can save big on the best Mother's Day gift ever with up to 50% off site-wide during Movement's Mother's Day sale at MVMT.com. Again, that's up to 50% off at MVMT.com.